come with us. Into the wild wood. And find the magic within.
Welcome, fellow travelers, into the Wildwood, a pagan podcast with your hosts, myself, Lee Red Oak, and over there in the corner eating the cookies is Rev Kai. Hello.
Nom, nom, nom.
All the usual stuff. If you like our show, please give us a thumbs up or a share or a like or whatever it is, whatever platform you're viewing or listening to this on. And check out the link tree in the description where you can find all of our links to our website, Discord, and Facebook. All right. Book talk number 6. Ta-da!
We read some books. It took us a little bit.
Yeah, I know. It's been a bit of a hit and miss, but I've actually got a long list here. I didn't realize I'd read this many, actually. So, I don't know. Should we start with yours?
I've got 4 plus 2 astrology books. I never really talk about the astrology books, but I'm always reading them. So, actually, I'll do those first. I've been reading Ancient Astrology by Dimitri George, Volume 1. Like, if you want to know about traditional astrology, you need to read this book. It is absolutely foundational. It's one of those books that you refer back to again and again. And this one I really enjoy because it is designed as a workbook. You get introduced to the concepts with the references in the ancient texts, which I think is very important. Studying ancient astrology, you want to study the original sources, and then you work through the technique with actual charts. And you know, that's really where it becomes so important in astrology. I mean, I always kind of consider it like the math division of the occult sciences and the hermetic arts. And just like when you're learning mathematical techniques, you need to practice them. You know, you get introduced to the theory, you see how it works, and then you need to do a whole bunch of examples and preferably also encounter it in the wild later so that you learn to build upon the techniques. And Dimitri George walks through that par excellence. I mean, really. I used to tell people, if you want to start with astrology, you know, buy the only astrology book you'll ever need. It is not the only astrology book you'll ever need, but it is a really good primer and starter, but it's very much modern astrology and with modern rulers and several other things. And, but if you want to get into ancient astrology, if you want to be able to do stuff, with the PGM, and the Picatrix and that kind of astrological magic, you need a good grounding in ancient astrological techniques and an understanding of core concepts like the Thema Mundi and essential dignities and why that stuff works. Because you can't do the inference you need to do astrological magical operations without that core understanding of what it is you're looking for. What are the qualifications you actually really do need? Because it's too intricate, it's too complex, and it's too customizable to do the cookbook approach. Because it can't just be like wealth, dignified Jupiter. Right? At least 6 other planets going on if you don't use any of the moderns or asteroids plus your angles. It gets complex really quick. So, yeah, I highly recommend that. I know we've had some people ask me, you know, what astrology book, or can I start with this or that? So now that I've read it, I should have read it long ago, but I finally worked my way through it. I can heartily say this is worth every penny. And there is another volume. There's volume two, which I ordered, and then like it ended up on back order, and I'm going to get my book. I really am. But
I actually had a similar problem. I ordered Martin McGregor's book. Now I've forgotten the title. But anyway, from our local, we have two local online stores, which are kind of similar to Amazon. It's Takealot and Loot. Loot's where I ordered this from. It's taken over a month to get to me. It's like, why? It said 15 to 17 days shipping on the thing, but it took over a month. So, yeah, I was a bit annoyed about that. But I got the book eventually yesterday, so started reading
it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, working in occult bookstores for years, I've gotten kind of spoiled about, oh, I want an obscure book. Well, I'll just order it from the publisher. You know? Yeah. But I ordered through a local bookshop so I could make sure to support them. And I'm sure, you know, they have to wait until they have a big enough order to place and all of that sort of thing. So, but I finished volume one and I like wanted to go read volume two, and also had a bit of nostalgia about back in the day when I'd have to like actually go to a physical bookstore and find a physical book and convince the bookstore owner that this book really did exist. And, you know, that sort of thing. Back before the internet, when research was a bit different. Or wait for the wonderful green characters on the black screen teleprompter at the library to be able to talk to the interlibrary loan to look for the book. But anyways, volume one, absolutely excellent. I have heard nothing but wonderful reviews about volume two, so I'm sure it's absolutely excellent also. And there is a YouTube channel, which, oh, I don't remember. But it's a couple of astrologers working their way through volume one, reading the chapters, discussing it, working through problems. So I'll look that up.
Yeah. That's vital. I mean, especially the practical exercises. I mean, that's vital for these things. It's brilliant, though. One book that I found quite interesting, it was an audio book I listened to, The Path of Freemasonry by Mark Stavish.
I like Mark Stavish. He's a good writer.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke about his book Egregores previously, which was excellent. It seems that he is a Freemason. He gets referred to, I think it was Don Milo Duquette who does the foreword and refers to Brother Stavish. So it seems he is. But excellent book, really good book. It goes through a lot of the principles of Freemasonry, but it goes a lot into the history, which is fascinating. It doesn't just focus on the development of Freemasonry and the Scottish Freemasons, etc. It goes into the Knights Templar. It goes into Amok and Rosicrucianism. So all of these little branches that developed from the Masons themselves. So very interesting. And each chapter ends with a summary of the chapter and then little exercises. They're mostly just visualizations, you know, sit down, imagine yourself in this place, you know, in a Mason's temple, and you know what you experienced and things like that. But he does end with a conclusion that, you know, with Freemasonry we have the exoteric and the esoteric sides to it, and a lot of it has become a lot of Freemasonry has kind of excluded the esoteric in the past years. So it's really, really more of the exoteric, the development of the community and helping fundraising and things like that. But a lot of people are trying to bring the esoteric back into it because of the younger people. So yeah, really, if you're interested in Freemasonry, or just finding out what it's about, because I think Freemasonry is fascinating. It is very much the root of what modern occultism is today. you know, Golden Dawn, Theosophy, Crowley's Dilemma, OTO, all of those developed out of
Wicca.
Freemasonry. Wicca, yeah.
Wicca is heavily influenced by Freemasonry.
Yeah, I mean, it all just branches out from that basis. And I mean, you go back to 1717 when Freemasonry formally came together again. Before that were the Masons, which spread across the whole world into Hermeticism.
Well, I would say Hermeticism was an influence on the Masons.
Yeah, yeah.
It's older. And I'd also say that, like, if you want an unbroken line kind of thing, that's where it is.
Yeah.
From the early, early Hermetic arts back in Mesopotamia and the Fertile Crescent, through Egypt all the way, and in esoteric Freemasonry. Of course, it's not the only line, but like you said, it's gone and branched out and influenced so many things and ended up in so many different places.
Mm. I think one of the interesting concepts about Freemasonry is the idea, I mean, the main reason Freemasonry developed was because they felt that Christianity was a dying religion. And they were trying to create this kind of all-encompassing, universal religious following that everybody, all men, could come and be in peace and things like that. Which is kind of what the idea of Christianity was, but it just somebody screwed it up along the way.
Paul.
You became Paulianity, yes. But it's almost like they're just saying that it's dead and trying to do the same thing again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so probably won't work that way, but it's an interesting concept anyway.
Yeah, I do find it interesting how the various Hermetic arts, because they are the core guiding principles for the roots of our civilization. Mm. They are woven in things in so many ways that you sometimes wouldn't expect. But, you know, everywhere you look, it's stitched in somehow. Some little piece, some little part. I think it's interesting that Freemasonry is seeing an esoteric revival. As we're also seeing, a higher interest in, I mean, astrology has gone off the charts in popularity. Paranormal research, after death and out of body experiences, all these things are really, really picking up. I mean, Saturn's in Pisces, so surprise, surprise. But it is tis the season for the renewal in not just the spiritual, but the esoteric, the magical, the occult. Yeah.
All right. Shall we do two of mine and one of yours? Yeah. I've got seven here. So we can do two and then one of yours.
And then I've got six. I'm not that far behind you this time.
Oh, no. Oh, in that case, we'll do one of yours now.
Okay, cool. Well, actually, I think we both read this one, Protection and Reversal Magic by Jason Miller.
Brilliant.
Is that on your list?
I read it a while back.
Okay.
But it's something I always come back to. Every time somebody asks about protection or protection magic, straight to that book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was an audiobook out and I read it long ago, but this is the revised anniversary edition. And he's gone through and added commentary. He decided not to edit and change the original text, but just add commentary where it was needed. And it shows, you know, the changes over time and the reflection of how the occult community understands magic and protection and reversal magic and the intricacies of different practices and worldviews and that sort of thing. So I completely agree. This is one of those, you know, return to go-to books for anything about protection, because it's not just, a book of magical techniques. Do this, do this, do this. It's in there. Absolutely. But it's also a rational discussion of what's really going on here. And all of the complexities that have to come up every time you talk about protection and attack and witch wars and this whole aspect of magic and the magic community. And, you know, because I've seen some wonderful protection books that have really good, viable methods in them, spells, usually as they're listed. But the philosophical conversation is just, you need to do this.
Yeah, not why. Yeah.
Yeah. And not the, you know, this is foundational stuff. If you meditate and cleanse your house and do your basic banishing every day, you're good. 99.99% of the time, unless you know you're purposely going into something that could be worse, that's it. Daily practice, 10 minutes, you're good. It's not, you know, all of this over the top, or what I find most people want, set it and forget it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to put up a ward and then we're done and we never think about it again. And so I really appreciate a book that you can hand to beginners that you can refer to that really does cover all of that stuff. This is, you know, all the things you really need to know in all the ways. Not just do this thing, don't question kind of situation.
Yeah. I think the main reason I actually enjoyed that book was because he starts out with those basic three things. It's meditation, banishing, and offerings. And if you do those on a daily basis, you're fine. But then he goes on, you know, there are various different types of attacks. It could be a spirit, it could be a witch, it could be whatever it is. There's all these different things that crop up in life. But then he starts examining those and gives practical examples and workings you can actually do to actually counter those or do the protection reversal magic itself. So you've got your basic thing that you do every day, but if you need the extra stuff, it's all in there. And he goes into so many different traditions. You know, there's
yes, I really there. Appreciate the yeah. the breadth of traditions and the comparison. So helpful.
As far as I remember, there was a large emphasis on Hecate as well.
Yes, there's several workings with Hecate. And he explains this because that's what he does. So he's going to share what he knows works for him. Because what else can you share like that? So, yeah, good book. Excellent, excellent book. And the audiobook is handy. I'm a big audiobook person, but I don't think it's enough. I think you're going to need to be able to at least look at a digital ebook.
Yeah.
Because there's, I remember the descriptions of diagrams and stuff like that that I had to later go look up.
But even the spell workings and the rituals themselves, I mean, those are things that you really need to have in written format so that you can follow it.
Yeah, I mean, you could write them down, but...
Yeah, yeah. So that's a definite recommendation.
Absolutely.
Everybody. All right. Next one on mine, which actually follows on from the path of Freemasonry, sort of, is Invisible Helpers by Charles W. Ledbetter. Now, I'm going to give a little plug for myself here. I've started creating paperbacks of arcane books or occult books, which are in public domain. But I'm not doing ebooks, I'm just doing the paperbacks because I feel these older books are they're things that kind of are being lost and they need to stick around for a long, long time. So I'm slowly, it's not facsimile copies either. There are a lot of people who sell these books as facsimile copies. these are rewritten and in a proper book format. So we'll be able to find them on my site, which leads you to Lulu. Oh, by the time this goes live, you'll be able to find out my site. I'm just redoing my website at the moment. Yeah. But anyway, so Invisible Helpers by Ledbetter. Now, it needs to be said that Ledbetter is a bit of a controversial character. At one stage, he was disgraced and forced to leave Theosophy because he was accused of being a paedophile. Then he was readmitted to Theosophical Society in the India section. And then the charges came up again, so he left and he moved to Australia, and that was it. So that should be mentioned, because a lot of people don't like to read books or listen to music from people who have been through some kind of, you know, accusation or court case or something like that. So if that's the case, don't read the book. Having said that, it's a very interesting book. Ledbetter was a Freemason and also joined the Theosophical Society back when Blavatsky was starting to create that. And the book itself, it's about invisible helpers. These are helpers which we cannot see. So they come along and they will help you with something physically. You may be in danger. You may be in a building that's on fire and you can't get out, or a child can't get out, or something like that. So they come along and they protect you and they help you out of the building. That's the kind of helper he's going into. And he speaks of nature spirits and the dead. But the emphasis is mostly on those who have reached a level of adeptship in astral projection. And these are the type of helpers he's actually focusing on in the book. And so the whole first section of the book is retellings of stories, different stories from different people about what they saw and what they did, or from the perspective of the helpers themselves. And then it goes into what you need to do to become a helper. And it's very much based in Buddhism and Hinduism. So, you know, it's one of those, it's a case of you have to go from this level to this level to this level, and it carries on. And it could take many lifetimes to get to this point. So it's an interesting discussion. It's not really something that's very practical, put it that way. From his point of view, anyway. You know, being Theosophy, you've got to expect that, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't heard that about Ledbetter. I'd heard, he's controversial, but I didn't realize that's why.
It was actually quite interesting, because I read Invisible Helpers first, and then I listened to Path of Freemasonry, and Mark Stavish actually mentions it in there.
Oh.
The whole controversy with paedophilia. Hmm. He was into little boys, apparently.
Ugh.
I know.
Yeah, and I don't know. I understand not wanting to read books by people like that, because you don't know where that philosophy is, and you know, it can be insidious. It's really creepy.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah. But I think being aware of it before you actually go in,
helps. That does make a difference.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't want to support people like this, if they are currently creating music or creating books.
No.
Because you don't want to support them financially, which is, but
right.
Ledbetter's long dead, so, it's a different story in that case.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Next on my list is Creating Magical Entities by David Michael Cunningham.
Ooh.
It's a hell of a good book. He goes through everything I can think of you need to ask about entities and what servitors are and how this all works. He really does break it down and go through definitions and thereby, I guess indirectly, not directly, encourage the reader to go through the same process and really actually work through this step by step. And I think that's really important. Much like protection and reversal magic, this is a book that doesn't just tell you how to do it, but helps you understand why and what's going on at every level you need to be aware of. And it's not in a "let me tell you how the world works" kind of way. It's in a "go examine this, go figure this out, look here, look here, look here" kind of way, so that there aren't, you know, weird philosophies and worldviews stuck lurking behind corners you didn't think to examine because you just needed to do this ritual. And so you took, you know, the appeal to authority and followed the ritual and didn't understand the worldview behind it or what you were really doing, what you were accepting, what you were getting into. So I enjoy that in a book. Because I think that's the kind of literature and educational material, I guess, that I want to be available for people new to the craft and people new to each practice. I don't want them to be getting Bibles that, you know, just say how things are and everybody just keeps pointing to it as that's the way things are. I want people to question and find this out and think their ways through it because they'll be better magicians. They will have a better grasp on what's going on and consequently have more success. So, good book. He does have personal examples in there too, which I think help keep it from being like a dry radio manual kind of text. You know, you can see how it was applied and what happened and get an idea for what you should keep track of through this process. What you need to keep records on, what you need to pay attention to, what time spans are normal. That sort of thing. So, good book.
Sure, I added that to my list a long time ago. I just haven't read it yet. It sounds familiar.
It's an old book, I think. I should check the publication date. Oh, it's teeny tiny on here. I'm old. Oh, 2003. I wouldn't say that's old, but I just realized that's 20 years ago.
I know. I have to. That was last year.
Pardon all of us born before the turn of the millennia. 2000 broke our brains.
But what you were saying earlier, just now, I have a fair share amount of people who are just starting out, and they say, you know, they did X, Y, and Z, and all it really is repeating a word or a phrase or something that they've been told. You know, that's how you do it. You just say this, and the magic will work. And they don't understand why it's not working. And it's because they, you know, there's a lot more to it.
Right.
But you've got all these freaking spell books out there that kind of go, take, here's your ingredients, say these words and put them together, and that's it. That's the magic. No, so much more.
And there's nothing wrong with those spell books if you have all the understanding behind them.
Mm.
They're like the notes you make so that you can go bake a cake. But they're your own notes. You already know you need to sift the flour, and in this recipe you need to, you know, blend the egg yolks with the sugar but whip the whites. And all that technique and all that understanding behind it informs the list of ingredients. Because that's all those are. They're shorthand notes with a list of ingredients so that you remember what to do. And if you, yeah, go ahead.
No, the problem is that those are the books that get marketed to the beginner. And they're only created in order to generate money.
So, well,
it's really
I do think that's the unfortunate situation now. I've seen several of those books. I'm thinking especially back in the day of the hoodoo formularies that were very common and sold fairly cheaply because everybody knew all the background techniques and how it worked. It was inside of a tradition that that was happening. So inside of a tradition, when you're practicing the same way as the other person, you can absolutely trade spells like that because you're working in the same paradigm. You have the same worldview. You know how to bake a cake. You know how this all works. You know the techniques. You just need some new ideas about how to put things together. Because that's what that is. And so, you know, I do think there is a place for those, but in today's occult community, you can't say I'm a pagan and I'm a pagan and expect to have the same worldview. No way. Or the same tradition or the same practices. You can't even narrow it down to traditional witch or, you know, demonolater. Or there, even these smaller things, there's going to be more variance. So it's much harder to be able to pass those things back and forth because all the background that goes with why you would do that isn't there.
Yeah. All right. Should we go do one of my paperbacks?
Mm-hmm.
I got paperbacks as well. This one. A Broom at Midnight. 13 Gates of Witchcraft to by Spirit Flight by Roger J. Horn. This is brilliant. I actually need to get all of his books because he's excellent. He really is. The main reason I love this book, he goes into, you know, the history and things like that, as most traditional witches will. But then he goes into the chapters which are specifically focused on the methods. Sorry, I'm just trying to get to one. So, for instance, we have the via equarum, which would be using the stang or the rod or the besom. Now, as I said, there's 13 chapters with 13 methods, different methods to actually get into or move across the hedge type of thing. Each chapter starts with a narrative, which is put into modern times. And each narrative has little traditional rhymes. So he has the narrative, which is kind of a storytelling of how it's actually applied. And then he discusses the history of it, right? How it was applied in reality through the old times. So each chapter goes through that. Then right at the back, he goes through all 13 again, but he actually gives a breakdown. It's kind of a, I don't know if you can see it. Wait, let me just
kind of tilt there, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. It's a breakdown of the steps that you need to take to actually apply the method. So it's laid out really well. It's structured really well. Let me just go through. So the 13 methods are stang or besom, the tree rite, which is sitting with a tree and going down through the roots, the hold stone rite, which is using a hagstone, rite of the grave, graveyard work, anointing rite, that's using, that's the via beneficium. Don't ask me.
Beneficium.
Yeah, don't ask me to pronounce Latin. and then it's the dream
rite. Just a little Latin.
Just a little Latin. then it's the dream rite, which is using dream work, water and cauldron rite, shape-shifting rite, obviously shape-shifting into an animal, cartomantic rite, which actually uses the Marseille tarot. Uses the devil, the moon, the fool, and the world placed in a certain configuration, and then you use that as a gateway. The wind rite is quite interesting. It's tying, using knotwork to tie the winds, and then release them when you actually want to do use spirit flight and let the winds blow you.
That's how I use it.
Yeah,
I have a whole little box of cords. Tied up.
There's the rhythmic rite, which is using rhyme. Rhymes and charms. Then the fire rite, which is using candle or flame. You can see there's definitely 13. Rite of the shadow, which is actually calling on the shadow of the horn god. Correctly. And that's it here. And fantastic bibliography in the back. Just it really, it's just, you know, it's not a big book, but it covers so much. It's just, I love it.
Sounds great. Definitely want to read it.
Yeah. But he's written some really good books by the looks of it, so definitely going to get into Roger J. Horn.
Yeah, I've heard that name several times in traditional witchcraft authors lists, but haven't picked up one of his books. Of course, haven't really been reading a lot of books until the last year and a half. Kind of took a break there where I wasn't reading enough.
No, I did the same. Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Gotta take a break from things every now and then.
Yeah. Yep. All things in their season. Okay, so the next book I read is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I hope that's right. Kimmerer? This book. It's about indigenous wisdom, the environment, scientific understanding, how our scientific worldview both rejects and intersects indigenous wisdom. It's a deeply moving book. It's not just to learn something, it's to open your heart to, you know, a new way of being or an old way of being, a very old way of being. And with the climate crisis and everything else going on, it's more relevant than ever. I should check when this was written also.
Very much you're connecting with the land type thing.
Yeah. Oh, let me see the about section, please. 2016.
Okay.
So
still wasn't last year, but yeah, closer.
Yeah. But this is just and it's not really like, oh, you know, witches need to hear this or pagans need to hear this or anything like that. I mean, an indigenous worldview, I think, is very germane to the vast majority of pagans and heathens and magic workers, just because it's part of what informs the vast majority of our sources. But this is one of those things I think every human should read or hear or listen to. And I started reading the physical book and very shortly realized that this would be so much better as an audiobook because it's like, you know, listening to your sister speak or listening to your mother speak and telling stories. So this is one of those where I think the audiobook is way better than reading the physical book, unless, you know, that's something you prefer for whatever reason. But I learned so much about the real core understanding of our modern scientific worldview just by the comparisons to what's going on, what's happening, the reactions, just thinking all that stuff through that, you know, I don't normally think through. My science worldview training is all in statistics and mathematics, which includes some of the scientific method, but nothing like biology does. You know, there's a whole different understanding of it. So, the author is Potawatomi. and I have several friends who are Potawatomi and have included their practices alongside the pagan community here. So that was interesting too, to be able to really put some more behind those experiences and what's actually happening. And of course, I live blocks from the Mid-America All Indian Center, which is like considered to be the place that hosts all the nations. So there's often representatives from 30 or 40 different tribes and nations within the Kiva and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of indigenous influence in our local pagan community, just because of where we are on the land. So still very, very important, and, you know, really made me think also about what modern wildcrafting is and eco-stewardship, what it means to care for the earth, what it means to dwell upon the earth, and how we interact with that. So, everybody read this.
I assume it applies to worldwide. It's not just America.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. Worldwide. She's talking about it, her personal land and interaction as a biologist in certain areas, which aren't anywhere near where I am. But, you know, it is a global view as she pulls it out and applies it to the bigger stories. So it's that constant back and forth between the personal experience and the big story.
Yeah, so one problem with these book talks is that my reading list just grows.
Right? Every time. Oh, here's this book. Oh, I read that. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to do my next paperback, Psychic Witch, Matt Oren. It's a fantastic book. And, you know, I was saying this previously as well. The care that's gone into the actual construction of the book. He's got, you know, the blank pages between chapters. He's got these illustrations. And it's just black and white. It's just plain, but it's just, you know, this fantastic design to the book. Now, Matt Oren's influence is very much Wicca. There is a lot of influence, I noticed, from fairy tradition in here, though. All of the concepts that he goes into. Being titled Psychic Witch, I thought a lot of people might consider it to be focused on how to open your third eye, how to see auras, and, you know, that type of thing. It's in there. It does include that, obviously, but it goes a lot deeper. It goes into all of the psychic senses, but it discusses magic from A to Z. It has, I'll show you the list of exercises. He's just got loads and loads of exercises for the reader to do. I mean, here's a list of exercises. It's one page, two page, three page. Wait, there's more. Four page. there's 93 exercises in this book to do. But the exercises start with your basic meditation, and they build on each other, and it takes you right through, and it goes into, there's four chapters discussing the soul and the three soul parts, and, you know, even in the soul parts, the exercises in there are very much kind of healing, and how to actually use your psychic senses in order to heal a person, either through distance healing or hands-on healing. So, you know, it's using the psychic senses not just to see auras or use your third eye or anything like that, but using your psychic senses for magic itself, in healing, in spell work, in all aspects of magic. He goes into the planetary forces, he goes into the elements, he goes into the various different energy bodies that we have. There's also a huge influence with the three cauldrons from the Cauldron of Posey. And it just, it's fantastic. And there's right at the end as well, I love it, it's multidimensional magic. And he breaks down how a spell work actually progresses from the physical through the different etheric bodies, or the etheric, the spiritual, the mental, the emotional, etc. How it goes through them, and it gets to the final energy body, and then it comes back into the physical. The explanation is, I think it's probably one of the best I've read. So yeah, excellent book, loved it. It's great for anybody, especially a beginner who wants to actually get that, you know, from your beginning right through. It's an entire system, actually. I mean, you can read this as a grimoire. So, yeah.
Good. I've heard many good things about it.
Well, I mean, the reviews. There's 4 pages of reviews. in the book.
I'm so glad that we are getting to the point where there are so many good books out there. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to start and to find a good beginner book, you had like 5 to pick from, and it's just because it was early on in the publishing of such things. And you know, I think the internet and the ability for people to communicate and talk through their practices with one another has really pushed the craft further, so that, you know, there are more people working at a higher level with a better understanding and the ability to write and publish books than ever before. And it's just, you know, more technology, higher communication, kind of thing. Because if you're writing letters back and forth, which, you know, I'm so glad people were writing letters back and forth and we have those to study and understand what they were doing. It's nothing compared to interacting with people every single day through social media and having the availability of all of the blogs and the articles and everything else. It's just, yeah. I was thinking about that the other day, that as we do these talks, we talk about, oh, I'd recommend this to a beginner, or this is good for somebody new, or that sort of thing. And, you know, 30 years ago, I couldn't have come up with that many books.
No.
I could be like, just start with this. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, we do often say that there's a lot of trash out there, and there is a lot of trash out there because it's become so easy to actually publish writings or videos or, you know, on blogs or in books, because you can self-publish quite easily now. But at the same time, because of that ease, because it's becoming more accessible, there's a lot of good books as well, a lot more.
Yeah. Well, it's just raised the number of books. The amount of available information is just increased exponentially. Because some people, you know, don't even necessarily read books. They read blogs and articles and follow YouTube and podcasts and that sort of thing, and never get to print paperback books or audio books. So it's just, I have a place in my heart for books and the smell, especially. But, you know, the proliferation of information also means that there is much greater accessibility. for everyone. If you like the way Matt Oren writes and he speaks to you, awesome. If not, that's cool, because there's still another 20 books you can check out.
Yeah, exactly.
And find one that works for you, where the author is speaking in a way you understand. Which just means more people get to learn more, more quickly. You know, it's cool. the next one on my list is Sigil Witchery by Laura Tempest Zakroff. Another excellent book up there. Mm-hmm. I actually met Tempest through belly dancing years and years ago. So it's always cool when these people I meet in the belly dancing community, later I find out they're like accomplished published witches and that sort of thing. That T-Thorn Coil. You know, it's an interesting overlap. So this is a really good book for getting into sigil making and sigil witchery that isn't Austin Osmond Spare or Goetic planetary squares kind of sigils. Creating magical entities does use those planetary squares type of sigils and that sort of stuff. So there's plenty of things in the book that I don't necessarily agree with, just because that's not the way my craft went and developed. Mm-hmm. So I didn't follow those strands and end up with those practices. But they're perfectly viable and readily accessible to many people, I think. And she talks about that the what I perceive as the more projective, fixed understanding of sigils that are a very constructed method, hence require a deconstruction component. So you create it, you do it, and you forget it. Because of the construction process, the deconstruction process is a little more difficult, because the construction process is very left-brained, even though that's not a thing, analytical. Whereas the approach she takes is much more intuitive. And because the constructive process is much more receptive and intuitive and flowing, there is no necessary deconstructive process on the other end. In fact, it doesn't make sense to forget it. It makes more sense to see it all the time. And that component is somewhere where I ended up in my own sigilic work long ago. And I think it's from influence from Galdrastafir, where the resulting physical form is itself a kind of talismanic object that is more than the sum of its parts. You know, so I found that interesting. I don't know if she goes quite into that analysis, but that's something I picked up on very quick. And there's, you know, good foundation in art history and the flow of symbolism through the ages. So while this may not be a sigilic technique that everyone jumps on, neither are the other sigilic techniques that are out there. So I would say, if you want to do sigil magic and you've already tried, you know, through the Kameas or through Spare's method or something like that, and it just doesn't fit right, give this a try. And this is one of those, you want to pick up the paperback book because you need to see the sigils and the patterns and the drawings and that sort of thing. They are described a bit in the audiobook, because I was listening to the audiobook while reading the paperback. And I should have went downstairs and got my stack of books, but I didn't. They're all downstairs. But you do need to be able to see this one. And I'm sure there's an ebook edition out there. If there's an audiobook, there's an ebook almost always.
There is, I'm sure. I read the book, yeah. It's a very fluid artistic approach to sigil creation, and she goes into all of the universal symbols like the dots and lines and chevrons and heart and arrow and things like that. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I read the book. Yeah. So there must be an ebook out there.
Yep. Although, I don't think she goes as deep as I would like into many of those universal symbols and their origins. She mainly stays in the modern realm with little dips back into a few cultures. But then again, you know, I'm one of those deep dive kind of people, and not everyone is. And it is a thin book. So it's a quick read, which is also important for a lot of people. Learn the technique, get in and do it. And this book really encourages that. Learn the technique and get right into it. Get to working. And she does have a whole section about artistic materials and using brushes and different kinds of paper and all of that stuff, which I was kind of like, why doesn't everybody know that? But not everybody's been raised by two professional artists that paint for a living. So I didn't even think about that until afterwards. And I'm reading this. I'm like, yes, everybody knows about brushes and third count and paint. And then wait, no, everybody doesn't. That's not the way the world works. I forget.
Actually, now thinking about it, that was actually an interesting, a great influence on my own workings, actually. Because I remember when I read it, I was still in a very kind of rigid, spare type of approach to creating sigils. And I remember reading it and thinking, I disagree with all of this. But at the same time, I didn't. But now, thinking about it now, my sigil creation has become very much going into a trance. I take an A3 pad, a drawing pad, and a piece of charcoal. And I go into a trance, and I just let the charcoal go. It's almost like automatic drawing. And that creates sigil, which is very much that fluid artistic approach. So that was actually a great influence on my own work, and I didn't realize it.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. All right. Yeah, great book.
Yes, great book.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. I'm just gonna mention the bad one. Dancing with Dragons, DJ Conway. Yeah. For some reason, Conway keeps coming up for a lot of people lately. I don't know why. And it's not just me. I thought maybe because I watched some video that was some guy who's doing dragon magic and he's teaching dragon magic and his influence was Conway, which kind of struck me as odd. I thought maybe because of that, all of a sudden it's popping up for me, but a lot of people have been saying the same thing. I noticed that Morgan Daimler actually mentioned in one of her posts recently, last week.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I actually shared that post. Somebody else said Conway's popping up for them as well. So I don't know why, but Conway's in the forefront at the moment, which is terrible. All right, so Dancing with Dragons, it's basically just your run-of-the-mill neo-paganism, and all she's basically done is changed the things like the watchtowers or the elemental forces and made them into dragons and given them names. And quite frankly, I think the elemental dragons, the names are completely made up except for one. Let me just find it. It was the, I mentioned it to you. It was the Norse god.
Oh, Fafnir?
Fafnir, yeah.
Not a god.
Yeah, well, what was?
Mythic what? Figure would be.
Mythic figure, there we go. But not a dragon.
No, Fafnir's a dragon.
Is Fafnir a dragon? Okay.
All right.
Then.
I think.
Got that one right. Because I went searching for these names, and the only one I could find was Fafnir.
Yeah, Fafnir's, well, a verm, which would be a dragon. Yeah.
Mm. But all of the others, all I could find were gaming references. So I don't know if there's any historical basis to them, but yeah, anyway. But regardless, Conway has had a bad name since the 90s. So never a very trusted source.
I wonder why she's coming up again. I wonder if she's having like a Uranus return or something.
No, she's dead. She died.
Oh, well, your chart goes on after you die.
Oh, okay. All right.
It doesn't end. I mean, you know, when names come back up and popularity rises again, it's often because of transits to the midheaven and certain returns and stuff. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. There you go. Learn something new.
Now I gotta go poke around and look at her chart.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I always wonder about those things when somebody just like, where did that come from? Why is that trending on Twitter? You know, it's that kind of question. And then I gotta go look at the natal charts.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, Dancing with Dragons. I actually originally decided to reread this book because I read it a long time ago. But I decided to reread it because she did bring out two follow-up books more recently in the 2000s. I think the last one was 2020 or 22 or something. That couldn't have been 20. Anyway, more recently. But I actually couldn't finish this book.
I'm not surprised.
You know, and it's even things like, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but Beowulf. I read this a while back now. I can't remember all the bits and pieces. But she Grendel. Is it Grendel in Beowulf? The monster. Yeah. Apparently Grendel was a dragon.
Grendel was a troll.
Yeah. I was searching and searching for some kind of relation to somebody mentioning Grendel being a dragon and couldn't. I think she even mentions that Grendel's mother was a dragon. So she's taken all these myths, and in some cases, yes, they were dragons, but in a lot of cases, they were not. She's taken all these myths, and she's just made them into dragons to try and make dragons sound better. So, yeah. I wouldn't really recommend Dancing with Dragons.
I wouldn't really recommend anything written by DJ Conway, honestly. This kind of stuff has called out in many, many of her books.
So. Yeah, there were three at the time. There was Conway, there was Eden McCoy.
Mm-hmm. And the great ancient Irish pumpkin festivals.
Yeah. And Douglas Munro. Well, we did mention Douglas Munro.
Yeah.
Yeah, you did mention that some people have followed the 21 Lessons of Merlin and actually with success.
Still, terribly sourced material, made up crap, not worth reading, in my opinion.
Mm.
But that was also apparently the age of the ironclad Llewellyn churn out a book for us contracts that people talk about. So who knows if it was the editors or the authors but it's all a mess. We have wonderful books that are good these days.
Yeah, no, I'm glad the Llewellyn thing's changed. I mean, the Matt Oren book is Llewellyn.
Yeah.
So at least they're bringing out some good stuff now.
Yeah.
Because I remember, you know, I actually saw somebody the other day that asked about a book in a group and thought that it was published by Llewellyn. And as soon as they see Llewellyn, they question everything.
And oh, yeah.
We used to do that in the 90s, early 2000s. You know, if it was Llewellyn, don't touch it.
That was pretty much the way it was in the 90s. It was considered a junk publisher.
Yeah.
You know.
I think they pulled themselves up.
Yeah, they seem to be doing much better. I don't really know what turned it around, because I wasn't interested in Llewellyn for quite some time, because they had churned out so much crap. The joke around here was that, you know, the Llewellyn symbol, the little moon inside the square, was the same as an outhouse. So, you know what you find in an outhouse. Yeah, that's what you find in those books. I mean, that's really what people said in the 90s and the early 2000s about Llewellyn as a publisher. So, yeah. But that has changed. They seem to be doing better, like you said.
Right, one of yours?
Yep. Another astrology book, because I think it's so important. Planets in Transit by Robert Hand. This is the book where there are broken out delineations that allowed, and you can read about it in the beginning of the book, the first astrological plug-and-play software that would give delineations, because it would be like this plus this equals this, and plug it in Mad Libs style. This is where that comes from. But that is not what is in the book. The book is a much more comprehensive delineation of understanding the most fundamental timing technique in astrology, transits. So, and it's old, very, very old. The cover looks like it was printed in the 70s. It's like kind of a Tron looking thing. But it's Robert Hand, so it's absolutely excellent. And again, this is one of those foundational books that you should have to reference and read at least once. I'm going back through all of these old books that, like, I read when I was first interested in astrology, and then I was like, I don't know, and, you know, put it away, did something else for a while, and got back into it. And now, like, you know, 15 years later, I'm like, oh, where are all those books that I read, like, a long time ago? I should go reread those now that I, like, know what the fuck is going on. So, it's a pretty short little book. My poor paperback copy has been taped back together with packing tape several times now. Probably because when I bought it, it was old at a secondhand shop. But if you're interested in understanding transit astrology, this is the basic, you know, oh, Saturn's going to square my sun. You know, what is going to happen and how that's going to go. You can read the first four or five chapters, the first bit, this theory, and then look up stuff and get through it. And it's a handy little reference book to have. And you do need some astrological understanding before you pick up this book. He doesn't introduce the signs. He doesn't introduce the underlying theory of astrology or that necessarily. And there's some math in there. Don't let the math scare you, because computer programs do that all now. This was written before we had computer programs to calculate charts. I think the math really helps understand what's going on. But as astrology becomes more popular, we have more and more resources and a proliferation of information. And I'm on several forums that are just basically ask astrologers questions. There are astrologers, there are people that have questions, they post their chart, they ask a question. And I've noticed that people are more and more aware of basic transits, basic astrological knowledge. 2 years ago, everybody asked about your big three, your ascendant, your sun, and your moon. Now people talk about your big six, which I guess includes Venus, Mercury, and Mars. Two more planets, and there's your entire traditional chart. But so people have much more grasp on the, I don't want to say the basics of astrology, the top level of astrology. They can see the flowers. And I think this is a foundational book if you want to get a little more in depth, if you want to pay attention to your own transits, if you want to work through that sort of thing. It would help in understanding astrological magic, because elections are transits. they're always a transit to your natal chart, and you always need to be aware of that. But it is written from a more modern lens. This is before Robert Hand became a traditional astrologer. He was a very accomplished modern astrologer for quite some time before he switched. And, well, not really switched, but gradually moved into a new practice. So, yeah, if you're into that sort of thing, definitely a good foundational book. Not something I would put in the hands of a beginner or somebody that's just passingly interested in astrology. You'd have to actually like want to pursue it or use it as a main tool in your practice.
Yeah. Like me. Passive. Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody's got a different relationship to it, you know? Mm. So whatever it is, wherever it is, because it's like tarot or pendulum work or any other form of, I don't know, bonus subjects in studying the occult. Right? Everybody has like mainline and your, what do they call them in school? Electives.
Mm.
You have your core classes and you need to pick two electives to fill out your schedule. That's kind of how I think about like tarot and astrology and herbalism and, you know, tincture making and all of that sort of stuff. They're electives, but everybody's got a few.
All right, so next one. Exploring Hermetic Traditions by Terence McKenna.
Fuck yeah!
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. And this isn't... I actually tried to listen to True Hallucinations after this, and I couldn't get through True Hallucinations. One, because it's not Terence McKenna. It's not his voice.
Right.
And two, it just... The stuff just goes way over my head. They go into medical stuff and biological stuff that I just don't understand. But Exploring Hermetic Traditions, absolutely brilliant, because it's actually recordings of talks that he gave.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes into so much. It's not just about Hermetic Traditions. He goes into so, so much in this audio. So it is unscribed, and I would definitely listen. Yeah, I'm watching it. Yeah.
It just, there is something about hearing the story directly from the author. And I mean, McKenna, he's got a very unique speaking style and intonation and delivery.
Mm.
He conveys much more information than just words.
He does. But, I mean, one of the things I was actually thinking about was that he's sitting there and somebody asks him a question and he just rattles off all this information and knowledge. And, you know, I kind of think to myself, I may have read something, but I can't remember what the hell it was. But he goes into detail, into dates, into, like, names. It's like... His recall is incredible.
Well, he does a lot of psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people think drugs equal bad memory, but there are certain kinds of psychedelics that drugs equal really good memory.
And he really has a good memory. Actually, there was one thing in here that he actually says, I think he says it twice, actually. People ask him if... I think it was specifically about... Oh, it was DMA. Is it DMA? No, not DMA.
DMT.
DMT. DMT. They ask him if DMT is dangerous. And his response is, if you think that something awesome is going to kill you, sure. If you think something mind-blowing is going to kill you, yep, it's dangerous.
Well, yeah. If you listen to Terence McKenna long, you know that a lot of people really do think that.
Mm.
That if they change their mind, if they blow their worldview, if they lose tight control of how they think the world works, then that's worse than death.
Mm.
It's so terrifying. to let go and heaven forbid perceive reality.
Mm. Yeah, scary thing, but it is necessary, especially on our paths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've just been listening to several podcasts recently about theoretical physics and, you know, local reality and non-local reality and how, you know, modern theoretical physics and quantum theory have basically disproved that reality is real. It contains no non-local reality. It doesn't hold that because the observer effect is in place. You know, we can't definitively determine that thing A was in state B before we observed it and after we observed it, only when we observed it. And it really just kind of breaks a lot of people's brains. And I think it's one more proof of magic. The big headline recently has been the future affects the past. You know, all of these equations for time, all of them work both ways, going forwards or backwards, yet why do we experience the arrow of time and what is going on? So it brings me back to a lot of Terence McKenna's philosophies frequently, off exploring theoretical physics, because whether you get there by talking to the plants or by going through the math, you end up in the same spot.
The little elves, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Little green men. But I completely agree. You know, listen to these conversations. And there's tons of Terence McKenna's talks on YouTube. I can share my playlist in the server if we can figure out which category it goes into. But I've listened to so much Terence McKenna over the years. I really love him as a stand-up philosopher, as Mel Brooks would say.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. We finished with yours, have we?
I have one more.
Oh, one more.
Okay. Maybe I didn't count right. I went back and reread something that I think everybody should be reading. Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft.
Oh, yeah, I've been wanting to reread that, yeah.
So, we haven't talked about it on here before, which, like, had we missed that? But we're early on, so a bit of an excuse. But this was one of those books that, like, you want to know what the real witchcraft is, baby? That's what was going around back in the day, compared to the outhouse books. And it starts with you say the Lord's Prayer backwards to unbaptize yourself, to get yourself out of Christianity, to be released from those oaths and those bonds. And back when this first came out, that was pretty controversial, and people were rather freaked out by it. And now it just seems like, well, yeah, you got to figure out how to deconstruct brainwashing, no matter what your brainwashing is. You know, lots of people are recognizing the prevalence of cults in our modern world and what it takes to deprogram from those and how important it is to go through deconstruction, which probably used to be called analysis, but that's what it's called these days. And it is an intentional deconstruction of a previous worldview. So, you know, while Hewson's book, of course, doesn't approach it in that language because it was years before that language was around, it still goes through that necessary process of breaking down those previous oaths and exploiting the power of taboo while you're at it, because you're not going to have that taboo once you break it. And this was something Crowley was always big on, using that power that is inherent in social taboos, which is something I don't think we really see in magic these days. I don't know. Maybe some of my Discordian friends are still doing it, but I don't hear it. It's not as common to pay attention to what those taboos are and understand that the breaking of any bond or oath will release an immense amount of power. And it often happens early on in our process of switching from one worldview to another, because it's how it works. It's one of the first things you need to do. You need to cross the line. You need to step over the threshold. You need to dare in order to will. So going through that process, perhaps a bit more opaquely in Hewson's book, I think is a good doorway for many people. And while this really does have a nostalgia about it for me, because this is early 80s, 90s craft that's really coming through.
Yeah, huh? It was 1970, actually.
Oh, it was? My copy's over there. I can see the book, but of course I can't see the title page. I guess Google's a thing. But this is still absolutely applicable to today's practices. And there's plenty of techniques. Yeah, you're right. Published in 1970. Plenty of techniques and plenty of rituals and workings that I think are really a good immersion in the craft. I would consider this kind of midway between traditional witchcraft and Wicca as far as influence.
A lot of people actually explain it as the breakaway from Wicca at the time, but it was also a breakaway from the Cochranite tradition.
Yes.
So it was really taking the craft into its own little area, traditional witchcraft, actually. But I mean, he goes in. I remember him going into Goetia. There's a invocation of Besigo in there, I think.
Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah. I think I read that like 20 years ago. I've been wanting to read it again. I just haven't gotten around to it. Yeah.
I will say that it's definitely a viable system that has very good bones and fleshed out, because I know a coven that has been operating basically within this tradition for many years. And working with these rites and these god names, that sort of thing. So, yeah, one of those books I think you should read, even if it's not going to be an instructional book that becomes part of your praxis. It's a cornerstone of the history of the craft, the modern craft.
Yeah, I love that book. I think everybody loves that book, actually. I don't think I've ever actually seen anybody say anything bad about it.
Oh, there was a local shop that wouldn't carry it, and then people who came in and asked for it got screamed out of the place because it was devil worship.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. The New Age Bible thumpers are strong here. Mm. Yeah, you can't mention anything dark or demon-y or with horns or anything. It's not of love and light. It's dangerous. You'll invite demons into your life.
Oh, God.
And you go, yeah, that's what I'm going for, man. They're like, so.
I can imagine we'd have a lot of fun. Yeah. All right, then.
That was a long time ago, but
meh. Probably still the same. I don't think we can really say much about this book. It is another one that I've republished, an old arcane cult book. Hieroglyphical Figures by Nicholas Flamel.
Nicholas Flamel?
I find quite interesting because Nicholas Flamel is said to be a fictional character. This is the actual Nicholas Flamel, apparently, not from Harry Potter or from The Alchemy. Well, there's a book called The Alchemist. It's a whole series. Martin Scott, I think the author's name is. I can't remember.
He didn't invent Nicholas Flamel. Flamel is in, like, history.
Yeah.
As an alchemist.
Yeah. This book is alchemy. But it is the practical alchemy. It's not the esoteric or occult alchemy. So, basically, he found a book that was, he paid like a few pennies for, and it contained all this wealth of incredible information and knowledge. And so it's basically about that book that he, that Nicholas Hamel bought, and then went ahead and did all the various operations and created gold three times over, which made him so rich and everything else. But yeah, I find it interesting because Nicholas Hamel is supposedly a fictional character in history. But, you know, we don't really know. I mean, even if there was an actual person who did these things, wrote this book, and just went by a completely different name, a pseudonym, a pen name or something, called himself Nicholas Hamel and made himself famous in that respect. Don't really know, but I thought it was an interesting addition. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Mm. Yep, and that's it for me.
That's it for me.
That's it for you. All right, then.
Yep.
So that's the end of book talk number 6. Thank you for watching, and tune in next week for something different. We'll see you then. Have a good
one. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.